the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver. Brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon again, and thank you very much for joining us this afternoon session entitled Human Resources and HIV/AIDS, Advancing Health Workforce Capacity in Delivering Care, Treatment, and Support. My name is Shoji Nishimoto. I am in charge of the Bureau for Development Policy at the UNDP in New York. Let me first have the privilege of introducing my co-chair, Mr. Leonard Rubinstein. He is the Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights. To my right is Mr. Rubinstein, who will co-chair this session. Allow me to briefly introduce our distinguished panelists this afternoon for this session. I have Dr. Tigist Guma. Dr. Guma is the Associate Director of the HIV/AIDS Department in WHO. I believe you are based in Geneva. Right. So, Dr. Guma, thank you very much for joining us. Next is Dr. Eric Schulten. He is an HIV/AIDS Coordinator at the Ministry of Health in Marawi. And I have Dr. Liva Fransen. Dr. Fransen. She heads the Human and Social Development for European Commission's Directorate General for Development. And next is Mr. Mark Haywood. He's the head of the HIV/AIDS Law Project in South Africa. Further down, I have Dr. Ibrahim Mohammed. He is the program manager of the HIV/AIDS program in Kenya, and he'll be speaking on behalf of the Minister of Health, Dr. Kaluki Engulu, later. So thank you very much for all the distinguished panel for joining us this afternoon. Let me just do a little bit short overview for this session. I may be preaching to the converted, but we all know that 25 years into HIV/AIDS epidemic, the number of HIV infection has yet to decline, and more than 40 million people around the world are living with HIV/AIDS today. The epidemic has already cost us 25 million lives, and in 2005 alone, I think more than 3 million people died of HIV/AIDS related causes. In the hardest hit countries, HIV/AIDS is undermining health services in a number of ways, from death of healthcare workers to the additional number of people needing treatment in understaffed and underfinanced hospitals and clinics. In addition, the migration of skilled labor, the brain drain, so to speak, of doctors and nurses, and underinvestment in human resources have had a severe detrimental effect on how health systems are coping with and responding to the challenge of HIV/AIDS. The implication in the hardest hit countries are obvious, but the challenges are also now applied in the countries where lower prevalence rates. These challenges range from ensuring financing for necessary prevention and care and treatment services to providing adequate remuneration to skilled health professionals, as well as to providing access to health care for the poorest citizens. It is evident that the weakened health system and the scarce human resources for health services are major barriers to scale up uninvested access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, as well as support. Action to bolster health services and systems resources must be taken urgently to implement comprehensive and effective national response to HIV/AIDS and to save countless lives. The international community and several countries have recognized the urgency of the situation and have taken steps toward addressing the issues related to weak human resource capacity in the health sector. WHO and UNDP have entered into a partnership to address the chronic health sector capacity challenge in high prevalence countries, and similar initiatives are being undertaken by other organizations. But we all know much more needs to be done. So today that we will discuss the human resource capacity constraints that constrains the scale up of HIV response and how we can do more effectively and more efficiently. In keeping up with the conference theme of time to deliver, the panelists will explore action that can be taken to stem the loss of human capacity and ensure access to HIV-related services. We will now start with a session with speaker presentations, followed by an interactive or Q&A session with the audience, and then close with hopefully some concrete recommendation for all of us to move forward. So now I'd like to invite my co-chair, Mr. Leonard Rubinstein, to give opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to welcome you as well today. This session has a rather bland title, Advancing Workforce Capacity in Delivering Care and Treatment. It might better be entitled Stopping the Destruction of Capacity, because the principal fact of health worker capacity, especially in Africa, is that people with skills to provide treatment and care and prevention for people with AIDS is that they're leaving. The Joint Learning Initiative now estimates over a million workers short. And the migration is so great that there are countries like Mozambique and Malawi which have populations in the many millions, and they count their doctors only in the hundreds. For nurses, the situation is in some sense even worse. And yet this crisis, and we need to call it a crisis, while very long in emerging, has been very slow to be recognized. 2 years ago, in Bangkok, at the World AIDS meeting, this very meeting, there was not a single session, not one, on this crisis. Yes, there were some sessions on training, on scale-up, but not a single session recognized what we now see as a key issue, the workforce crisis, especially in Africa. In the last 2 years, though, a lot has happened. My own organization at Bangkok released a report, an action plan to stop the brain drain and provide for equitable health systems in Africa. The Joint Learning Initiative report came somewhat later. WHO began to make this a priority. And here this week, we've had Bill Clinton and Bill Gates both talking about workforce capacity development and ending the brain drain. So now it's on the agenda. We need to understand what is causing this crisis. There are a number of factors, but a few are particularly important. One is that health workers in Africa are underpaid, work in very poor conditions, and have very few incentives to stay, especially for the second reason, when they are at risk themselves of HIV. One study showed that 17% of health workers in Africa are HIV positive. They also work in situations where they don't have protective equipment, they don't have supplies, they don't have drugs, they often don't have running water in clinics. And finally, we can't leave out the role of developed countries, for they go and recruit health workers by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, to make up for their own failures to provide training to meet their own population's needs. This panel will talk about a number of solutions, a lot of innovations, a lot of thought about what can be done. Those solutions go across a range of possibilities. Most of all, it's going to take money. It's going to take a lot of money, mostly from developed countries, but also from developing countries. It will take equipment. It will take supplies. It will take health infrastructure. It will take increased salaries and salary supplements that must be allowed under macroeconomic policy. It will, in some cases, take substitution of one kind of health worker for another, and in particular, the training of a vast cadre of community health workers. So all of these are on the table. It is tragic, quite tragic, that 25 years into the epidemic, we're only talking about this now, but we must talk about it now. So I now invite the panel to begin that discussion. Our first speaker is Dr. Kages Gherma. She is Associate Director of the HIV-AIDS Department at WHO. Dr. Guerra has vast experience in public health at the national, regional, and global levels. Having worked for over 18 years in developing countries, she's made several important contributions in addressing HIV, including working with national governments in developing regional and national strategies on HIV/AIDS in Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Health services depend on having the right people with the right skills in the right place. But the world is experiencing a chronic shortage of well-trained health workers. The 3x5 initiative has once again confirmed this clearly, that one of the major obstacles for scaling up HIV treatment prevention with the shortage of health workers in the high-burden countries. To address this problem, the World Health Organization launched yesterday the Treat, Train, and Retain Plan, which is an important component of WHO's effort to strengthen human resources for health and to scale up HIV prevention, treatment, and care toward universal access. It's a short overview of this plan that I will be trying to cover in my presentation. For those who are interested to know more, the document is available in the back of this room. Where are the critical shortage of health service providers? 57 countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also including Bangladesh, India, and Indonesia, face crippling health workforce shortage. WHO estimates that over 4 million health workers are needed to fill the gap. Within this number, the global deficit of doctors, nurses, and midwives, in particular, is at least 2.4 million. Sub-Saharan Africa faces the greatest challenge, with 24% of the global burden of disease and only 3% of the world health workforce. What does the face of the crisis look like? The flow of this diagram illustrates the cause of the health workforce problem as a work-life cycle of three phases: recruitment, distribution, and attrition. Too few people are being trained and enrolled in public health sector. Then, there is an even distribution of the pool of skilled workers with high concentration in urban areas and many preferring to work in the private sector. Many resign due to the pressure of poor working conditions and low pay, while others migrate to better jobs abroad or with the private sector and non-governmental organizations and even international organizations. But the leading cause of attrition is HIV itself. In the countries where HIV prevalence is high, huge number of skilled health workers simply fall sick and die of AIDS. In Botswana, estimates show that 17% of the health workforce died of AIDS between 1999 and 2005. If no action is taken, this percentage is projected to reach 40% by 2010. In Lesotho and Malawi, death from AIDS is the largest cause of health workforce attrition. The health workforce crisis is part of a vicious circle of a weak health systems and weak HIV response. Weak health systems mean low coverage of HIV services. This will make HIV prevalence rise, which in turn places an increased burden on the health services. An ailing health workforce further undermines already weak health systems, and weak health systems result in an inadequate response to HIV epidemic. What does all this mean? It means that currently the response to HIV/AIDS depends in large part upon a limited number of people who are not fully skilled to deliver services and are themselves getting sick and dying of AIDS. With this situation, achieving universal access for HIV prevention, treatment and care will remain a dream. We need to find ways to improve the numbers and skills of the health workforce. One of the solutions that WHO is putting on the table today is treat, train and retain, or TTR. What is exactly TTR? TTR will address the health workforce crisis in countries mostly affected by HIV. It consists of three elements. First, treat. Treat includes testing and counseling of health workers, targeted prevention campaign, including education and training for occupational health safety and stigma and discrimination, and providing treatment to health workers in priority and care and support to help them face burnout and stress. What will WHO do in this? WHO will assist countries in developing a package of tools for tailored intervention for health workers using its existing material. Second, train. Train includes increasing the number of skilled health workers entering the workforce by developing pre-service and in-service training. But as you know, it takes time to train. It takes 6 years to train a doctor. So the other solution is to have task shifting to make better use of available human resources by decentralizing tasks from doctors to nurses and from nurses to community workers, including people living with HIV/AIDS. What will WHO do in train? WHO, in collaboration with the ILO, will support countries to develop standardized and systematized programs for training and certifying professional and non-professional cadres. It will help define health legislation to regulate task shifting, to allow prescription by nurses, and also to allow lay workers to do some tests. It will also build on the experience of task shifting already implemented through the Integrated Management of Adult Illness, or IMAI, in many countries. Third, retain. Retain includes developing strategies to enable public health system to retain workers, including financial and other incentives and measures to improve the workplace, as well as initiatives to reduce the migration of healthcare workers. What will WHO do? WHO will advocate for financial incentives and measures to improve the workforce. We'll support countries to develop and promote sustainable and equitable pay scale. As you can already see, guess, TTR will also need money. WHO has already undertaken an analysis of the cost that will be involved in the implementation of TTR. TTR will cost a minimum of US $7.2 billion to be implemented over the next 5 years in 60 highest burden countries. This is a lot of money, would you say? But if you look at it carefully, $7.2 billion represents an increase of the annual per capita of approximately US 60 cents of the countries concerned. or it is between 3 and 5% of the levels of health expenditure typically found in low-income countries. This is, of course, additional funding. But for an important issue such as human resources, which currently is a major obstacle for scaling up most of the disease programs, it could be justified. Funds need to be mobilized from external and national resources. In conclusion, I would like to say that TTR is a broad and multifaceted AIDS health workforce plan, which focuses on the special needs of the health workforce for the first time. It needs to be owned by countries and be integrated into national planning. It will depend on an alternative models of healthcare, such as task shifting and the involvement of people, communities, and people living with HIV/AIDS. TTR will combine the coherence of systems approach with the speed required to respond to the AIDS emergency. Partnership and cooperation will be essential and we look forward to working together with all of you during the implementation of this plan. I thank you.
Thank you. Now I'd like to invite Dr. Eric Schotten to give his remarks. Dr. Schotten is the HIV/AIDS coordinator at the Ministry of Health in Malawi. A medical doctor by training, Dr. Schotten has been involved in addressing HIV/AIDS both in the Netherlands and Malawi. He has been integral to the development and management of several HIV programs, including improving access to ARV treatment, as well as Malawi's Emerging Human Resource Program. Dr. Schotten, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I will speak on the Malawi government's Emergency Human Resource Program. Something doesn't work. I will speak about some of the experiences and also we'll look into bit to how our experiences can be used in other countries. Let me start to tell a little bit about Malawi. Small country, a poorest country in Eastern Africa, 12 million inhabitants, with almost a million people infected with HIV, or 14% of the adult population. An annual death rate of 90,000 people, and a severe human resources crisis. This crisis is not new. And it's not something that emerged suddenly. But it was, even though many reports have been written about it, and I've seen reports in the early 90s, only recently it was recognized and was being addressed. Yes. To give you a few examples about the severity of the crisis in Malawi. More than 50% of positions in health facility are not filled. There are some districts with less than one nurse per health facility, and there are districts without doctors at all. Although the human resource crisis affects many countries, the severity differs from country to country. I'll give you an example and compare the number of doctors and nurses per population in several African countries, and the situation in Malawi is among the worst. Another example is to compare the number of patients, the number of people in need of ART, and I used the 3x5 numbers as published by WHO, the people in need and treatment, and the number of doctors per country. And also here we can see that Malawi is among the countries with the fewest number of doctors. I believe the situation in countries like Lesotho is more or less similar. Well, people have been asking why. What is the reason for the human resource crisis? Why is the crisis in Malawi maybe poorer or worse than other countries? And I think a long time underinvestment in training. HIV/AIDS itself aggravated the situation. Structural adjustment policies did not really help, to say the least. And human resources for health was not a major theme in health reform movements in the 1980s and 1990s. Also, there are some in-country issues, poor retention, push factor had been set already, low wages, high workloads, not good supervision, inadequate housing for health workers. People have to often to work in terrible conditions and often been seen as a weak and unresponsive human resource management. But also on the other side, poor factors, often been spoken about international migrating and also domestic dynamics. Growth in research groups, jobs. Malawi is a country where many organizations would like to do the research, and also pulled towards NGOs and private sector. This also led to us, when we were developing the scaling up program of AIT in Malawi, that there was one thing we should not do. We knew if we're going to follow a medicalized model where doctors delivering AIT, where there's a multiple choice of regimens, there's a mandatory laboratory monitoring, CD4 counts, full blood counts, etc., computer follow-up, we are not going to achieve a massive scaling up. But instead, to address these issues, we had to develop another program. And we based the program on realities in Malawi and what we call a public health approach. First instance, we knew we had to keep it as simple as possible. A rolling out of a first-line regimen only, one regimen type for all patients, no need, no necessity for laboratory monitoring or CD4 counts, simple drug supply system, high level of standardization in case finding, treatment regimens, reporting and monitoring, being inclusive, basically using all providers possible. Mission hospitals, although often in Malawi we see them as a part of the public system, profits, non-for-profit private sector, and using lower cadres of staff involved. And recently WHO calls this task shifting. First, development of the program have been what we think successful. We went to 128 sites in the country, and at this moment, roughly 45,000 people are alive and on treatment, and 60,000 people ever started treatment in Malawi. But we have to go further. Our scale-up plans speak about 45,000 patients to put on treatment every year. There's about 50% of people becoming eligible for treatment every year. One question is how universal this is. But what I want you to look at is at this moment about 1% of our adult population is on treatment. And in 10 years' time, we expect that around 5% of our adult population will be on treatment. This is a massive scaling up. We're speaking about probably at least 2 million contacts with the health sector every year. The big question is, how are we going to do it? We have to be innovative. We have to look at innovative approaches. And we are further developing them. But anyway, apart from innovative approaches, a simple ways of scaling up AIT, we need to do something about the global situation of the human resources in Malawi. When Malawi was developing the proposal for round one, people knew that the human resources crisis was severe. And a big component of the round one application was focused on human resources. Well, at that moment it was refused. And the funding level was substantially reduced. But basically what happened in the years, in 2004, when we were starting looking at the scaling up, at that time our Secretary for Health really was speaking about, well, the health system in Malawi has collapsed. And we had a visit of Chakrabarty and Piot in February 2004. And I remember when we were preparing for this visit, it was basically one thing what we would like them to understand is we cannot scale up unless something is done about the human resources crisis in Malawi. And very soon, this was recognized. And 1 minute, yes. And we were speaking about, they were speaking about exceptional measures that need to be taken place. And consequently, we developed a six-year human resources relief program. This also was not something new. Basically, we had this laying in the drawers. 270 million program funded through a reprogramming from Global Fund. Global Fund, and I recommend them for these, of the flexibility and the change in thinking, is supporting 100 million. DFID supported 100 million, and different donors through the swap, the remaining $70 million. Some, what we were looking at in this program, expand the training capacity by 50%, improvement of retention and re-engagement, some additional salaries, extra recruitment of staff, which starts to work, and temporary stopgap measures by having extra doctors and nurses, nurse tutors into a country. I'll skip this one. If you're looking at what is our experience in Malawi, it's probably too early to speak about success. Human resources, you won't change them overnight. It is a long term. For example, increasing of the capacity for training. It'll take 3, 4, 5 years before we see the first people coming into our system. The question also was asked to speak about what are the experiences in Malawi, what could other countries with similar situations, what could they do? And I think because it takes time to do anything about human resources, the first step is to develop a public health scaling up of the AIT program and other AITP programs. Keep it simple, standardize it, be inclusive and use the lower cards. How inclusive, how low depends on which country you're working and what are you able to do. But also to perform a workload analysis on the HIV, but also part of the essential health package that you have. And on that basis, you can develop a bold plan for scaling up. And on the basis, you know how many additional human resources are needed. And to my idea, this includes an economic analysis. How many health workers? How many teachers keep alive with the AIT program? We often have been asked how many people you take away from other health essential services. We haven't finished our study, but we believe to a large extent the numbers of staff that is focusing on the AIT program, that's working for the AIT program, probably would not have been there if there was no AIT in the first place. And on the last place is get support, get good plans, get support for us. We were able to get support for our needs, and I believe this visit 2 years ago of Chakrabarti and Peels was essential in a step in recognizing the problem and also to get support for a program, and eventually led to a large program of $270 million that was fully funded by donors. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Dr. Lieve Franson. She is the head of human and social development for the European Commission, Directorate General of Development, and vice chair of the Global Fund to fight HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. Dr. Franson has a long and distinguished career in public health, where she has worked with governments, managed research programs, and founded task forces with the European Commission. She received the Jonathan Mann Award in 2001 for special merit in addressing HIV/AIDS.
Thank you, chairs, panelists, ladies, gentlemen, colleagues and friends. I hope my health will allow me not to cough too much during this presentation. And I'm wondering if you really hear what I'm saying, because I hear more what it has been said behind us, so I hope you don't have that disturbance too much in the room. Well, the previous speakers have already shown very much how we are facing a critical shortage of health professionals in the poor regions in the world with the highest disease burden, and how little attention has been given to that in previous years. It is actually keeping me awake. How could we forget that we needed nurses and doctors and health professionals? And unless we expand rapidly the healthcare workforce in poor countries and limit the brain drain, we will not be able to improve health and confront HIV and AIDS. Doctors and nurses are needed. And the Malawi example is quite striking how creative people can be, but there is a limit, a breaking point, I think. In a few minutes of my presentation, I would like to share with you some critical data and some of the actions Europe is engaged in to help address the health providers' crisis. I'm sure you will, at the end of my presentation, think that we might have to do even more, and any suggestions will be very welcome, because I think, in my opinion, this conference should come out with a real urgent plan for scaling up healthcare resources. And if we, the conference here in Toronto should be a breaking point in the right direction, I believe. The first cause, there are three main causes from our perspective. The loss of health professionals in poorer regions due to migration to wealthier regions for higher paid jobs and better opportunities. But looking at the figures, 37% of South African doctors and 34% of Zimbabwean nurses have migrated. In Ghana, 3/4 of all the doctors immigrate within a few years of completing medical school. It is incredible. The debt. The second cause is the debt of health professionals. Our colleague from WHO already mentioned. And actually, the attrition rate through debt of health professionals caused by HIV is actually even higher than the migration caused by... But both together, obviously, are really very, very high. The third cause, I think, sometimes not enough mentioned, is burnout and demotivation of health professionals in some countries, especially in the Southern African region, where HIV is highly affecting the whole population. I personally was a district medical doctor in my young years, and I was in charge of 300,000 people, and I can tell you that I burned out too at that stage, and we didn't have HIV. So how you deal with that now, I'm very... very respectful for people still doing the job in their countries in that kind of situations. For the moment, we miss 1 million health workers and in Africa alone, and 4 million healthcare workers to provide basic health services alone. I'm not sure that we can grasp the numbers, the extent of the numbers. And 1 million only for Africa, 1 million healthcare workers. We don't train them in a few weeks. It took me quite a few years to get trained as a medical doctor and then to really be efficient at a certain stage. I needed even more training, so I'm not sure. In Europe, we have 10 health workers for every 1,000 people, and we want more. We attract more. While in Africa, we have fewer than 0.8% per 1,000 people. And in some rural areas and remote areas, as has shown in Malawi, there are not even any. But to provide health services and general care for HIV specifically, but also in general, we need nurses and doctors. People with HIV, women delivering babies, because we should not forget, we are here at an AIDS conference, but we also have women still delivering babies. We still have children in need of immunization. We still have other problems in health that need to be tackled. And all of that together, all of these people, women delivering babies, cannot wait to get help if they need so. Just as people with HIV need to be treated now. They cannot wait for 7 years for the medical doctors to be trained. So we need creative ways. The creative ways, some of the creative ways have been shared with us already in Malawi, but we need much more, and this conference has already shown a few of them. But we need to really have a break point here. Now, a little bit about migration of health professionals. Migration of professionals is a global phenomenon, and that's globalization, and it has a positive side, as long as it's associated with circular mobility. People come and go and exchange and work together. However, today, the promises of better pay, better working and living conditions and career opportunities pull health professionals away from regions where investments, working and living conditions and opportunities are lowest. The result is a continuous and often irreversible migration of a larger number of health professionals from the south to the north and from rural areas to urban areas. Because let's not forget, also in the countries themselves and in the regions, we have migration and mobility. In Rwanda, for example, some provinces that receive less than 2 per capita per person to spend on health get depopulated from their health professionals. Other provinces receive $12 per person per capita. Obviously, health workers are migrating in that direction where there is more to do because there's more investment. So health professionals, donors should work with governments to allocate resources in a more equitable way across the different regions in a country and in a region. Now, this year, WHO, as we've just heard, has called for a 10-year global effort to counter health workers. And we in the European Union have immediately responded with a positive call for action. And the call for action is firstly focusing at what we can do in developing countries, and second, what we should do also in Europe, because Europe is also part of the problem and possibly part of the solution, and not only Europe. But as being in charge of Europe, I'm talking about what we should do and what we are doing. First of all, in the developing world, first we help secure access to HIV treatment and prevention for health professionals. Health professionals sometimes don't go for treatment, don't go for testing, because they are afraid to be discriminated against. And we should stop this. We need all of the health workers possibly, even if and also if they are seropositive and need treatment. Second, we support innovative ways of providing treatment for people with HIV to community workers, for example, the Malawi example and others. Several good examples have been shown here, and I hope you all have good exchanges about these so that we can multiply the examples in countries as fast as possible. Third, we support leadership and stewardship of countries to set priorities in their health. Even the small resources, human and other, are not always used most efficiently. And governance have to do better with the help of donors to set more urgent priorities of investment in training of health providers and providing good livelihoods and salaries. We therefore in the European Commission provide longer-term predictable financing to cover recurrent costs for training and salaries of health professionals. The European Commission is providing financing for human resources through budget support. For example, in Zambia, a total of 100 million euros over a period of 5 years. That means that there is more predictable financing and countries can plan for the health professionals, and health professionals can see a little bit more of a predictable salary coming in, although 5 years is probably still not enough. We should, but very few donors have schemes that they can support longer. In Europe itself, we also take some action. Ministries of Health, first of all, in the member states are working together very recently to assess the needs for training and recruitment of health professionals. Europe's open borders increased mobility and health of health professionals and also patients across the continent, and European countries need to manage their health resources better and plan for training across Europe. The European Union is also exploring the development of a code of conduct for ethical recruitment of health workers to guard against active recruitment of health professionals from the poorest countries. The UK already has such a code, and the possibility of extending the acceptance of such a code for Europe is under urgent consideration. Third, the European Union acknowledges that legal migration and health workers' mobility is an individual right, and I want to make that statement quite strong, and can have very positive benefits for individuals, families, and their home countries. However, their benefits depend upon well-managed mobility, which we don't have for the moment. So in conclusion, we in the European Union and worldwide have started responding to a crisis. We start seeing the crisis, but we don't have the time to respond in normal ways. So we really need to have even more creativity and more willingness to work all together to solve step by step the crisis of human resources. This is the only way that we will be able to provide universal access for prevention, treatment and care for HIV. Otherwise, we will fail to save lives and ensure healthy populations in general. And healthy populations are critical for poverty reduction, for economic development and for security worldwide. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to now have the pleasure of inviting Dr. Ibrahim Mohamed. He's a program manager of the HIV/AIDS program in Kenya. He is speaking on behalf of the Minister of Health, Kariki Engelu. So, Dr. Mohamed, please.
First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting Kenya to speak in this forum for advancing health workforce capacity in delivering treatment and care. As has been introduced, I'm representing the Minister of Health who, for unfortunate reasons, was not able to come to this meeting. The first case of HIV/AIDS was described in Kenya in 1984. In this short 20 years of its existence, this deadly pandemic has caused untold suffering and pain to many people around the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where the prevalence is in some places is as high as 30 to 40%. The current prevalence in Kenya is 6.1, having dropped from 13% in the 1990s. HIV/AIDS is responsible for at least 1.5 million deaths in Kenya, and it's estimated that there are about 1.6 AIDS orphans in Kenya. The single most important limiting factor for HIV/AIDS treatment and care scale-up in Kenya is the lack of sufficient staff for the management and care for people living with HIV/AIDS. According to the Ministry of Health data, the health workforce has declined in size from 50,504 workers in 1996 to 42,910 in the year 2001, and this is still reducing. At the same time, the health system is straining to cope with new and increased pressures due to challenges posed in the area of HIV/AIDS, which include staff attrition, increased HIV/AIDS-related workload, absenteeism, training needs, and staff recruitment embargo. The rapid scale-up of treatment has necessitated the trainings and redeployment of healthcare workers in HIV care services. As these services continue to expand rapidly, the number of healthcare workers providing comprehensive care services is being outstripped by the demand. The need to employ and deploy staff according to need cannot be overemphasized. As services are decentralized, care is going to to move to the level of healthcare centers, health centers, where staffing is normally even more precarious. This will require that district health management teams guarantee to support healthcare workers at more peripheral level to ensure that services are not disrupted. Provision of quality health services, particularly in delivering services for HIV/AIDS, is a labor-intensive business, which require qualified health workers. Owing to the number of those infected countrywide and other complications that arise from HIV/AIDS, there has been a gap in human resource in our health institutions. An investment of $50 million per year for 5 years is required to have in place a reasonable number of healthcare workforce able to deliver quality healthcare. Human resources in terms of numbers and skills required is a major constraint hindering progress towards the achievement of universal access to HIV/AIDS prevention, treatment and care by 2010. Also, attracting and retaining skilled staff is a challenge for various implementing agencies, structures and institutions. This is attributed to the government pay structure, which is often lower than the private sector, which controls a large pool of skilled staff. Availability of adequate numbers of well-qualified human resource is a challenge for the government and the various ministries and institutions established for coordination and technical service delivery at the central and provisional level. Actions being taken by the government to respond to the challenges of scaling up HIV prevention and treatment and care include ongoing trainings and increased enrollment in medical training colleges and universities aimed at building a national pool of health workers. Another action being taken is human resource needs implementation for the national response being incorporated into the overall human resource planning. There is also need to train and retain more health workers. To reduce the turnover in the health sector, it will be important to introduce retention strategies. For instance, health workers trained with government resources have to be bonded to limit migration to other countries. The other is hiring of skilled staff for the ministers of health and remunerate them adequately to avoid high staff turnover. The other is to provide adequate resources to develop civil society caregivers to be able to provide home-based care services. In conclusion, at the international level, we would like developed countries limit hiring of health workers from developing countries. Developed countries should support trading of healthcare workers in developing countries. And developed countries should provide debt relief to create additional resources to support human resource development. And finally, international financial institutions should remove barriers on hiring of healthcare workers based on macroeconomic stability concerns. Thank you.
Our final speaker today is Mark Haywood, who is senior researcher at the head of the AIDS Law Project at the Center for Applied Legal Studies at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He's treasurer of the Treatment Action Campaign and has a very, very long history of advocacy in HIV and human rights, and has consistently worked for equitable access to HIV/AIDS treatment. He's been involved in successful public impact litigation on the rights of people living with HIV in South Africa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think as the last speaker, I have disadvantages and one advantage. The disadvantage is that much has been said already. The advantage is that perhaps I can comment on some of it and try to draw some of the strands together. The first thing that I want to say is that I believe that the human resource crisis is not just a global crisis, but is a globalized crisis. And what I mean by that, and as the earlier speakers have demonstrated, is that if you pull the string in one part of the world, it unravels often in another part of the world. So Canada steals healthcare workers from South Africa. South Africa steals healthcare workers from other African countries. The South African private sector steals healthcare workers from the South African public sector. The urban areas steal from the rural areas. And I make that point because if it is a globalized problem, there has to be a global framework to the resolution of the problem. Not just a series of ad hoc patches that may give remedies of a temporary nature in some countries, but will store up problems further down the line. And I'll come back to this point in a few minutes' time. The second issue that I want to make is that I think in having this discussion, we're struggling from the rhetoric of recognition of the problem to practical steps to address the problem. And we've got to take that gap sooner than later. And although HIV gives us an immediate cause to square up to the healthcare worker crisis, as Lieber Franzen said, it would be a mistake to justify sorting out the human resource issue solely on the basis of scale-up of HIV services. We need to replace health at the center of the development agenda in the way that was recommended by a report that we all seem to have forgotten about, which was the report of the WHO Commission on Macroeconomics and Health from 2002, which contains many important recommendations. So I would suggest that we need to identify a number of short, medium, and long-term steps that need to be taken. Not just the emergency measures which are necessary, but the measures that we need to embark on now, which we will only be able to deliver, or we will only see the results of in 4 or 5 years' time, or even in a decade's time. I want to make some suggestions in each of these areas. The first is that I think countries have to recognize that even in the face of resource constraints, sometimes we have a greater resource base than we imagine. In South Africa, for example, nurses complain that there is a need to change scopes of practice to make it possible for nurses to provide treatment and care to people that is currently prohibited by existing legal requirements. We need to look into that and make recommendations. The second is that the World Health Organization should recommend that the large informal health workforce that exists in many of our developing countries is brought formally into the health sector. In South Africa, it's estimated that 60,000 people are informal healthcare workers. That is, that they work on a daily basis, providing counseling, providing care, providing a variety of different types of support, but receive very little or no remuneration or training or recognition as a consequence. That is a precious resource that, if it is to be sustained, needs to be costed for and to be treated with respect and dignity. And the third thing that I would suggest, and the list could be much longer, is that we need to identify the critical areas of shortage and make plans for those critical shortages. It hasn't been mentioned yet, But pharmacists, for example, there's a terrible, desperate shortage of pharmacists in developing countries, not just doctors and nurses. And when we talk about rollout of antiretroviral treatment, for example, you'll go to many areas and find that there may be a doctor and there may be a handful of nurses, but there's no pharmacist. And without a pharmacist, you can't dispense the medicines. So we would say to developed countries and to developing countries, find a way to help us deal with those critical bottlenecks, which if we don't deal with in the short term, will paralyze our ability in the medium and long term. And then finally, or almost finally, I would take what Lieber Franzen has said and what the WHO has said and say we need to go further than what you have proposed. We need an international agreement on the human resource issue that binds, in the same way that the WTO agreement on TRIPS binds countries in conduct in relation to the distribution of human resources in our health systems. Voluntary agreements will not work. Already, the British agreement on poaching healthcare workers is being circumvented. I can tell you, it hasn't stopped healthcare workers from South Africa from being recruited by private recruitment agencies in Britain. We have to look at something more binding. And I want to suggest three components to that. The first is that there should be minimum conditions for healthcare workers. There absolutely has to be a set of minimum conditions. Minimum conditions in terms of remuneration, minimum conditions on a range of other things. Because if there aren't minimum conditions, then the circulation will continue. The second is that there needs to be a legally binding agreement to stop the poaching of healthcare workers from one country to another country. A legally binding agreement. And the third is that there needs to be some sort of concrete plan for the production of healthcare workers. Not just a vague statement that we need more doctors and nurses and pharmacists and so on, but a targeted, quantified plan to start that production. And there has to be a recognition that in developing countries, our ability to produce healthcare workers has been gravely limited by the loss of skills and the hemorrhage of skilled teachers out of developing countries, often to developed countries, and therefore the onus on the training of a new generation of healthcare workers has to be placed on the developed world. Not exclusively, but there is a direct responsibility in that regard. So I want to conclude with, I think, 4 points, and they're all very brief. Point one, we have to involve healthcare workers in this discussion. In the same way when we talk about HIV, we talk about the principle of GEPA. We can't have these discussions if the voices of doctors and nurses who are on the front line and of their trade unions and staff associations are excluded, which very often they seem to be. Point two, we have to approach the human resource question as a human rights issue, and I say that as a human rights activist. Various international covenants talk about people's rights to the highest attainable standard of health. The highest attainable standard of health needs to be quantified, and it needs to be both a moral and legal driver for addressing the type of problems that we are discussing. That would help us with an international agreement because many of our governments have signed international covenants that create specific duties around public health and population health in the countries we come from. And finally, I want to suggest that AIDS and our response to HIV gives us a model for what we have to do now in relation to human resources. It gives us a model because we're starting to look at AIDS in terms of targets and the monitoring of whether we meet the targets that we set. That has to happen with human resources. It gives us a model because we start to look at AIDS globally and we coordinate our response to HIV rather than solely looking at it at a national level. And it gives us a response because we raise funds for the response to HIV
and we should take a similar approach to raising funds for the production and sustenance and development of a healthcare workforce, not just for AIDS, but for public health into the 21st century. Thank you.
We'll take a number of questions at a time, and we have three microphones? And we'll, why don't we take three, one from each. Start with microphone one, and then two, three, and then we'll answer them.
Thank you. This is great, and I was worried that this discussion would never take place at this meeting. Thank God. I'm Laurie Garrett from the Council on Foreign Relations. We've been putting a lot of energy into this, and I want to take Lieve's challenge, why don't we come up with some solutions? And jumping off of Mark saying, we're looking at a globalized problem. We've been trying to say, how can we go to an economy of scale that makes sense? Why should it be that Malawi and Kenya are ordering drugs at ridiculous prices when there could be a global high-volume ordering mechanism with a global high-volume procurement and distribution system? The same goes with the frontline infectious disease care. We strongly believe that we need to create a vast army of community healthcare workers, but not just to address HIV, but integrating the major infectious disease killers into a single frontal assault package. If we don't, what's going to happen, and all our data shows this, is that we're going to have a net increase in death due to draining healthcare workers away from the less glamorous diarrheal disease programs in children, vaccine-preventable diseases in children. And then we will look back at this time and say AIDS killed the health programs of a vast majority of the population. It's essential that we be talking about this now as an integrated problem, that this human resources crisis is not just an AIDS ARV rollout crisis, and that we seek solutions that raise all the boats at once.
Thank you. My name is Andy Devereaux from Mindset Health in South Africa. My question is directed at Mark. Mark, in terms of what you're saying about task shifting and letting the informal health workers do a lot of the work, letting nurses dispense and so on, a concern that's been raised in South Africa very often is that there's no standardization of training of the informal health sector. You can do a one-day course or a one-year course and you're still called a lay counselor. So in light of that, I wonder if you could please comment on the amount of damage that could be done by ill-trained and ill-prepared people. And also, having done a lot of research with nurses, we do a lot of training of nurses, and I was just wondering if we had to sort of pitch your response to the healthcare worker crisis to them, how would you respond to them saying that taking healthcare workers and forcing them to work in their country of where they were trained is a human rights violation on them? I disagree with that, but I'd just like to hear your opinion. Thank you very much.
Can we keep the questions short? You see a lot of people have questions. So microphone three.
Okay. Emily Freeberg from the Toronto Youth Force. There's a lot of young people here discussing in prevention issues, but one of the Millennium Development Goal targets is also decent employment for youth. And I wonder how youth are involved in the strategies as part of the strategies and the recommendations of these scaling up plans, and how many young people are part of the trainings that are taking place.
Thank you. Let's go around one more time and then ask the panelists to respond. Number one, microphone.
I'm Lee Green from the AIDS Treatment News. My question is to Mark Haywood. I have a brief question about how the recent South African legislation limiting the contract of foreign health workers, limiting the percentage of foreign health workers in South Africa, has had an effect on the public health sector, positive or negative.
Thank you. Number two, please.
Yes, my name is Brooke Baker. I'm from an organization called HealthGap. My question is about the risk that we confront that the donors will impose employment conditions on the new category of community health workers that will be highly contingent, highly low paid, and stipend based, and continue an ethic which is really called these workers volunteers. A slight improvement in status, a slight improvement in training, a slight improvement in connection to the formal health sector, but fundamentally not addressing the need to professionalize, as Mark was suggesting, and also to put into the public sector this group of employees, to formalize their employment, to pay them a living wage, to train them and support them and help them in their career development.
Thank you. Microphone three, please.
My name is Ingrid Leroux from South Africa, and I have a question to Mark. Mark, your colleague and friend Zaki Ahmad has challenged the West and the North to institute an international community health service year like we have for doctors in South Africa. Is this an option? Could this fit into the human resource needs of the South to institute a type of peace corps with health workers from the North and the West to the South?
Thank you. Let's pause here and let the panelists take up these points. I'm sure, Mark, you have a lot to say on this one, Mark.
In relation to the question, I didn't get the person's name from Mindset, but what I'm saying is that we have to recognize that there's this significant informal health sector workforce, and that the health sector has become dependent on that workforce, particularly in relation to HIV. When I'm saying we must formalize that workforce as part of a package of interventions, I'm not saying so in order or suggesting that we should reduce the quality of the care. I'm saying formalize and train in order to improve the quality of care. Formalize and standardize training, formalize and improve remuneration so as to also improve the morale of the people who provide those services. Because I can tell you, when people get a salary 1 month and then they don't get one the next month, it's not particularly good for the quality of counseling that they do in relation to HIV testing. On the question of whether, I don't think you can stop, that you can force a healthcare worker in a developing country by law to stop them from migrating to a developed country. That is not possible. But what you can do is you can reach an agreement by law, is stop developed countries and agencies in those countries from creating the basis for drawing people out in the first place, together with improving the conditions of healthcare workers in developing countries so that there is less of a need to go. Because as you know and I know, a lot of healthcare workers, say from South Africa, who go to Dubai and go to all the sorts of places, don't feel happy when they go to other countries. They go for material reasons. And also, there are a lot of healthcare workers who exit the health system altogether. We often don't talk about them. We think they all just get poached. But a lot of people just stop being nurses and stop being doctors and they go and do something else. The impact on the public health sector of South African legislation. Well, South African legislation has started to change, but I think it's a difficult and a delicate balance, because South Africa would also have responsibilities not to steal healthcare workers from Burkina Faso and from Congo, so, and a whole range of other countries. So you know, we need foreign healthcare workers in South Africa, and we need to take away disincentives of people coming from developed countries. But it's a balance. It's a complex question to try and answer in 30 seconds. The last question for me on the International Community Health Service year, I think it's a very good idea that developed countries should encourage students, medical students, some sort of community service. I think, you know, Laurie Garrett would agree that in a context of increasing infectious disease crisis across the globe, that for people in England and Canada to actually have to deal with these type of diseases would be beneficial. But it shouldn't be a panacea. It has to be something that is looked into alongside more profound and long-term solutions to this crisis.
Thank you, Mark. I would like to now ask Dr. Guma from WHO to comment on this globalized issue, globalized solution.
Yes, I would like to comment first of all on health workers for HIV versus the health sector. I think it is very important that we realize that the health workforce problem was there for years and years and years. It was a chronic disease of a health system. But it's only with HIV, and particularly with 3x5 initiative, that this has been highlighted once again. And for the first time, and you said it here, that all the people in the conference, Clinton, Bill Gates, everybody is talking about human resources for health. But this was there for us. So what we have to do is really use HIV/AIDS as an entry point to strengthen human resource for health and in general health system, because that is where the funding is and that is where the attention is. If we don't take this opportunity, we will be again left over for years, because this has happened for years and years. So it's important that the health workers that we, the human resources that we will be strengthening will work for the whole health system, for the whole health sector. But we have to use this opportunity. That's my, it's on the globalization. Of course, it is a global problem. It can't be really patched, as Mark said, but we have to start by doing the first step. And as Maliva said, we need to have short-term, medium-term, and long-term solution. The short term is to use this entry point for of disease program to strengthen human resource for health. But we need to have a global solution to strengthen human resource for health. Thank you.
Dr. Franzen, I think there were some comments on to the preparedness, so to speak, from the north, from the European side, for instance. How would you be sort of prepared to come to discussion with the issue of the conditions or so-called compensation, that if the northern countries are to take on the health workers from the south, what sort of scheme that you can think about how to help the both the short-term and the long-term shortage of health workers in the south?
Again, I'm not sure I totally understand. I mean, we hear very badly here, but I would not talk about compensation. I think we need really to look at the global problem and find a global solution and take each of us our responsibility. What I was trying to express also is that Europe has a responsibility, has recognized it, and is trying to respond to this now. For the moment, we're looking at a code of conduct that is voluntary. I take the point, and that could be a discussion further in how far voluntary will get to it. We also are very committed to increase the training needs, because the training needs and the capacities in Europe and in the developing world. We're working there because the problem is also across Africa. We're working, the EU works very closely with the African Union on this, and I think there's an important aspect there, and I hope WHO can also help further in improving the know-how about in standardization and formalization of health workers. That is not a decision that the EU or the EEC itself takes for countries, actually. I would like to make, while I have the floor, also a comment to the suggestion about the infectious disease response rather than HIV. I would really plead to look even further than infectious diseases, because I'm not sure that for the moment I have striking examples where pregnant women have less and less care when they need it, because there's more and more pulling away from non-infectious diseases. And pregnancy is not a disease, but if you are in front of a difficult delivery and you need attendance, it is really critical, and I find it really sad that the world has given so little attention to maternal health and women's health in that context. So I think we're coming back a little bit to the essential package of what is essential to be dealt with. And I would very much strongly agree again with what my final words in my presentation were, also to put health in the center of the attention. We have neglected health for years. We have not invested, the world has not invested enough in health, and that is true across the world. And now we have a crisis that is, unless we have a large-scale response to it, we are not going to solve it, because Europe is still attracting more people because there is an increasing perception, at least, of a need for more health workers, whereas we stopped for years the training of healthcare workers in Europe because there was the perception that we had enough. Thanks.
Why don't we take some more questions over microphone one?
Thank you. Rebecca Hurtis from the University of Oxford. I welcome the adoption of a treat, retain, and treat, train, and retain program, and I think the rhetoric is very seductive. But my concern, like Mark's, is that it saddles the poor world with responsibility. Now, regarding the rich world, Dr. Franson has spoken about the EU's responsibility regarding treatment, but I think that in terms of the fact that 3 million people died of AIDS last year, you'll have to forgive us if we're a little bit dubious about the EU's sincere commitment to treating people dying of AIDS in the poor world. And you also, Dr. Franson, spoke about mobility as a solution. And I'm a bit concerned and confused about how increasing mobility is going to address the brain drain of health professionals to the rich world. So to Dr. Guerma and Dr. Franson, how can poor world countries hope to retain their medical staff when they are actively poached by rich world health systems to patch up their own flagging health systems? And I'd like some concrete solutions in this regard.
Okay, second. Microphone two.
My name is Sally Simpson. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm based in Toronto, Canada here. I've worked for 17 years in the field of HIV/AIDS. I've had brief experiences in a southern African country, practiced in a rural clinic for about a month in an HIV clinic. And I had some experience as well in an Eastern European country having to do with nurses, physicians, and social workers in HIV. So I speak from a place where I'm Canadian, however, I have some perspective. And many of the things that I've heard here today are wonderful, very, very, very welcome news. There were some things, however, that I had some concerns about, and I'd like to make a suggestion from the place of, from my opinion as an RN, and that is that we begin, as you are beginning to examine this plan and to roll it out, however that might be, that you examine the hierarchy of the medical system. I heard today, and Dr. Shouten, please forgive me, but I saw today that we talked about lower cadres. In my experience, all people who are interested in working in HIV/AIDS care, no matter where they are, should be welcomed. And they should be treated with the same dignity and respect, as Mark, you had said. And community healthcare workers have much to give. Volunteers have much to give. And I agree, volunteers should be considered professional people. As registered nurses, we are the folks who tend to know most about our patients, and yet we are often silenced within the traditional medical system. And I strongly recommend that this would be, if this could be rectified, that this would be an attraction for nurses to stay within the nursing profession. Thanks.
Okay. Number three.
My name is Alan Harris, and I'm from Zambia. I've been teaching in the medical school there since it opened, so that a lot of my children in the medicine are probably at this meeting. In fact, I've run into a lot. And I want to talk about a resource that you seem to be forgetting, those who are being retired when they should still be giving something of their knowledge, their wisdom, their skills. Very often governments say, retiring age, 65, or even 60 for very many nurses, and they don't want to retire, and they could still go on. I'm approaching, and not too far off my 80th birthday, and I'm still working full time. I'm capable of working 9 hours a day. Yeah. and let anyone dare tell me that I don't know how to learn new tricks. I know quite a lot of old ones as well. And I can put this knowledge to your service. How many of you at this meeting, who were about 40, 45 when the AIDS epidemic began, are now approaching retiring age and going to get out of it, saying we've done our bit? Why don't you stay in and do a bit more? Thank you.
We'll take three more, and unfortunately we're already over time, so everyone else will have to come up afterwards. I'm sorry. But let's take the last three, and then we'll have answers.
I'm Susan Strasser. I'm based in Lusaka, Zambia, and I too want to reiterate the sentiments of the nurse from Toronto. Thank you for reducing my blood pressure a few degrees. I am very saddened that there is not a nurse on the panel today. We are not a lower cadre of health worker. We are the cadre of health worker in rural southern Africa. I worked as a nurse. I've worked as a nurse in southern Africa since 1988. And when I went there in 1988, by 1990, our hospital was chock-a-block, full people on the floor with HIV and AIDS. We had lots of HIV and AIDS patients, but we did not have a doctor. That's the reality for us. We do not have doctors in most of the places where we work. We need the support. We need the training. A month ago, I was in Zimbabwe, and I went back to that hospital where I worked. And the nurse that's running that hospital told me, I said, Sister Maggie, how's the hospital? She said, we're doing okay. We have no pain medicine. We have no IV fluids, and we have no doctor. That's today.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah, it is undenying the fact that we want the number of nurses to be increased. First of all, actually, I should introduce myself. I'm Major General Professor Mathew Rahman from Bangladesh. I am the Chief HIV Advisor. Now, the question remains that we should not take it in a myopic vision. Every country has got its own sort of peculiarity. We should not define developing country and developed country. The developing country, when we talk of, then we talk of the disease burden. It's a question of the disease burden. Some of the countries, they have got number of the diseases are much more. They need more doctors, they need more nurses, they need more support. So the other part is the question of the country where the disease burden is less, there we have to put more money so that we train more doctors, more nurses, so that whenever they are in difficulties, they can fall back with their increased numbers. Now, by telling that, what I really mean, if you say the brain drain, what is brain drain? You say brain drain in a free world. We are in a free world. Every profession, they are moving in a free world without having any restrictions. It is the government. It is a sovereign nation to decide whether they need to send their doctors to other country, having that need be fulfilled. And that is what is the question. So we cannot impose, say in my country, say Bangladesh, we are having only 658 HIV/AIDS positive cases in our country. We have got many doctors, we have got many nurses, we have got so many things. So our doctors, I personally feel that they should go to the other country where there is a need, they learn and bring their expertise to be utilized in our country. So what I really very strongly feel that it should not be a generalized terminology. It should be a country specific and the disease burden specific and need specific. And the other question he has already mentioned about increase the retirement age and others. So I hope that should be the approach, not penalizing a country by telling being developing nation as we are a developing nation. So thank you very much.
Number three.
Hi, Tesmerelda Atzbaha from UNDP Angola. Just an issue that I haven't really heard brought up is the south-to-south transfer, and specifically in Angola in rural areas, there's a great dependence on North Korean and Cuban doctors, and I haven't heard this mentioned. I know also in rural parts of South Africa, a lot of dependence on Filipino and Cuban and doctors from other parts of Africa. what are some solutions in terms of thinking about incorporating these doctors? Many times there's linguistic problems with incorporating these doctors into the hospitals that they're working, and also into the HIV care. One of the issues we have is in terms of inviting these doctors to trainings. They're a lot of times left out of trainings by the government and not seeing as necessarily focal people, even though they're the ones who are there and sometimes the only ones available. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm afraid that we have to do an implied sort of cut off the discussion anymore. I would like to invite the panelists to make very short final intervention, please.
Nice. Okay. Let me start, because I started the presentation. So let me say, first of all, that I have the highest respect for nurses. I have worked in many African countries as a practitioner, and I know how, the load of work that nurses had and how they manage by themselves without doctors. So what we are proposing through TTR is a teamwork, is a clinical teamwork. We want to decentralize, and we want to give more power to the nurses, to the community workers, and to the people living with HIV work, to work as one team to support, to provide services to HIV patients. I think that is very important. The other thing on which I wanted to comment is we are proposing a concrete solution. The concrete solution that we are proposing is health workers are dying. We can't train in a very short time a number of health workers. We want to expand the existing health forces. To expand the existing health workers, we first have to save them from HIV/AIDS. We have to treat them. We have to prevent them from HIV/AIDS. That's why we want to give priority to the health workers, for them and their families to get treatment, prevention, and for them to be alive and provide services to the healthcare seekers. I will just stop there and ask the other.
Thank you. Dr. Shorten?
Yes, thank you very much. On three issues. One was mentioned, if ART and scaling up of ART or other HIV services would deplete health workers from other essential services. We have been looking into it. We haven't finalized it. But what we see that quite a few health workers' lives are saved because of the ART treatment. And some, I think WHO did certain studies that up to 30% of health workers in countries with a prevalence of 15% could be lost in 10 years' time if there's no treatment available. So the effect of having less health workers for other services, I'm not so sure if this is really as severe as we thought, including me, a couple of years ago. Second point on retirement. A part of the emergency scaling up plan is to ask people who are already retired, to come back and to work for several years in the civil service. And the point on lower cadres, I mean, the cadres we're speaking in Malawi is doctors, where there's an absolute shortage of. Nurses, also an absolute shortage. Clinical officers, an absolute shortage. All health workers, whatever cadre, is an absolute shortage. It was very clear from the beginning we could not scale up compared to other countries where you can scale up and doctors are prescribing ARVs and following up of patients. This is simple, not possible. We wouldn't be anywhere, and I probably wouldn't be here to present anything on what happened in Malawi if we've chosen that route. At this moment, we're scaling up for clinical officers. It has a cadre that is a shorter training than a doctor, and people doing excellent work. ARVs are, and ART is being followed up at this moment mainly by nurses, and they're doing an excellent job. But we're looking more, and we already made that decision, that medical assistants with a less training, and I'm sorry if a lower cadre gives some people high blood pressure here, but And we believe and we see that medical assistants do an excellent work and are absolutely able to scaling up. And we have to go further. If you really want to make a change, we're having to go to other cadres than traditionally seen that should prescribe this to still, in many countries, very complicated type of drugs. There's also a part in recognition of the good work is being done. And if the lower cadres is here only mean is people with a lesser or a shorter training than some other cadres. Thank you.
Dr. Franzen?
Okay. A few quick responses to some of the comments or questions. First of all, the EC and the EU are providing support since years for treatment, care, prevention in general and for health. And I would not like to leave the impression, I mean, the EU together, we are providing 60% of the overseas development aid worldwide. Obviously, this is not enough. It is going to increase now quite rapidly towards 0.7% of GDP. That was promised years ago. Again, too late, but we are still the largest donor of overseas development aid worldwide. The package, the issue is there that the package in general should be increasing and the focus on health should be increasing worldwide. And that is true for domestic resources as well as for overseas development aid, I believe. Let me also correct that the EU is providing 60% of the budget for the Global Fund. Again, the Global Fund doesn't have enough funds yet. And I'm the vice chair working very hard to make sure that the Global Fund gets enough funds so that we can continue seriously with the work. But that being said, I think I've heard quite a few interesting suggestions. I have very high respect for nurses and loved working with a lot of nurses when I was a district doctor with 300,000 people as the only doctor. Surely the only way that we could work was with volunteers, community workers, and nurses. And I'm sorry that we have not worked further since the 30 years that experience for me happened, is that we didn't upgrade the recognition of nurses, the standardization of training and the legislation around what nurses and other workers in the health sector can do.
Excuse me, I think
that is might be the right moment to do so.
Excuse me, Dr. Franz.
Yes,
we have unfortunately been told we have to vacate the room, and so the other panelists won't even get a chance. We could have had 2 hours more to discuss this. We're sorry we didn't get to continue, but thank you all, the panelists, and sorry to the last two.